Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Rebel forces in Darfur by getting the rebels to turn on each other. The fighting has raged in Darfur since 2003 when rebel groups attacked military outposts. Government-backed Arab militia groups known as the Janjaweed then went on a killing spree, burning close to 2,000 villages to the ground and leaving nearly 500,000 people dead. The U.S. has called the fighting in Sudan genocide and is now scrambling to save the peace deal. Farah Stockman of the Boston Globe joins us on the line with more from Washington. Farah, welcome.
Thank you.
In addition to this news, yesterday Sudan rejected the UN plan to deploy 21,000 peacekeepers in the area to replace the African Union troops that are there. First of all, why did Sudan reject that plan?
Well, Sudan has been very reluctant for years now to have peacekeepers in the area. It's accepted some African Union troops, but has consistently denied them access to vehicles that could help them do their job. And Sudan doesn't, frankly, doesn't want foreign peacekeepers there because it wants to do its military campaign.
Well, former Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick, who since left the government, brokered the peace deal 3 months ago. Only one of three rebel factions signed it. What were some of the criticisms of that deal?
There wasn't enough compensation for displaced people. There wasn't enough international monitoring of the disarmament of these militias that have been killing people and chasing them from their homes. And, you know, the peace deal also did not allow for UN troops to replace the African Union. And so a lot of humanitarian groups are now criticizing the U.S. for rushing this deal through when these pieces didn't come into place.
It also sets up a situation where this one rebel group that signed the deal is now taking advantage of that. The Sudanese president told the UN that he would implement this peace agreement by launching attacks on the rebel groups that didn't sign it, and we now know, you know, enlisting the rebel group that did sign it to fight the fellow rebels.
Yeah, it's quite Orwellian. Sudan gave a very detailed proposal to Kofi Annan saying that they wanted to implement the peace agreement to protect the civilians of Darfur by essentially attacking groups that didn't sign it and their sympathizers. So everyone is has been trying to convince Sudan not to go this route and to allow the UN peacekeepers in, but it seems clear that they've already started their offensive against these groups.
And why would the one rebel faction that signed the deal fight against other rebels?
Well, Sudan has a long history of being able to get rebels to turn on each other or enlist a few of the weaker groups to join it and fight their own people. This group, led by Mini Menawi, was under a lot of pressure to sign the deal, and they were the only group that signed it, and a lot of people think they now want to sort of gain back territory that they lost from other rebels by joining this offensive.
Well, and so now we have 2 million people forced from their homes, about 450,000 killed since 2003, rebel groups fighting the Janjaweed and each other. What is the sense of what has to happen, and how is it going to happen?
A lot of people think that these groups need to go back to the negotiating table and be able to really hammer out an agreement that's acceptable to everyone. People who are in the Darfur region say that Darfuris don't accept the peace deal and that, you know, the U.S. government and Mini Menawi are the only people that accept the peace deal. That's not a situation that's going to end the violence.
Well, what do aid groups say needs to happen more immediately?
I think there's a big fear right now that renewed fighting is going to cause humanitarian groups to close down and stop their services to these millions of people who are living in refugee camps. And this is a huge impending humanitarian catastrophe that needs to be addressed right now.
Farah Stockman, reporter for the Boston Globe on the failed peace agreement in Darfur. Farah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Words, their meaning, and their usage are very important to us at Here and Now, so on this Friday we thought we'd spend some time on the subject. To never split your infinitives is foolish, but we feel sometimes you just have to. And to end your sentences with prepositions is something we sometimes put up with. Linguist Jeffrey Pullum agrees. Pullum is professor of linguistics and distinguished professor of humanities at the University of California. He's also co-founder of Language Log and co-contributor to the book Far From the Matting Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. We spoke recently, and I greeted him as the master of language he is. And scared of you.
Don't be scared.
Well, the fact is you're known as not being the language police.
That's right. Linguists are interested in how it does work, not interested in looking at how it works and telling people it should work some different way.
Right. You're not, you're not wagging your finger at us.
No.
No.
But
let's give people a sense of how you do listen to the world. For instance, you talk about Ray Charles's musical rendition of America the Beautiful. Now, I might listen to that and think that it's lovely. You did as well.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the nice things about writing for Language Log is you can just put in digressions and things. And I wrote about the experience of being at a concert, seeing Ray perform when he was 73 years old. And I'm so glad I did. But I realized one day, as people were playing a lot of his music on the radio after he died, that when he embellishes "God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood," as he sings America the Beautiful, he actually says something, "God done shed his grace on thee," which reveals that he's presupposing that's a past tense.
You
and I realized it's not a past tense,
no.
It's actually a subjunctive.
Well, now let's back up. A subjunctive is the mood of the verb. Have I got that
it's
right?
It's just a construction that we use for certain purposes, like exhortation and so on. In this case, "God shed his grace on thee" isn't about what God did. It means "may God shed his grace on thee."
It's a hope.
And you can tell from what Ray Charles actually says in the embellishment parts that he didn't spot that. And I thought that was an interesting linguistic point, but not from the standpoint of finger wagging. Mm. It just revealed to us that there are very subtle aspects of English grammar where all of the evidence conspires to conceal from you the way it really works. The wonder is that most people get most stuff right most of the time, because the system's really fantastically complicated.
It is, and in that case, just staying with "God shed his grace on thee," it's not about saying, "Don't you understand that's a subjunctive?" It's about opening it up to a new understanding of the line. Wow, that is beautiful. It's a prayer.
Yes.
Right? Let's hope you shed your grace.
Absolutely.
On America.
Yes. It's not a triumphalist statement that God has shed his grace on this great country and therefore we're great. It's actually begging God to show us some grace.
Huh. Well, I want to jump to, because there's so much, but let's jump to split infinitives. You point out that sometimes splitting the infinitive makes the sentence easier to understand. I think I did use one at the beginning when I said, "To never split your infinitives is foolish." Now, explain the split infinitive thing.
Well, the nice thing about the split infinitive is such a clear case. Everybody thinks that they can write a sort of harumphing letter to the press saying, split infinitive, and they're always right that it's always a mistake. And the truth is the extreme opposite. It's never at any time been a mistake in English. It has been grammatical for 700 years. All the finest writers use it whenever they please, and you can plunge into almost any classic book and find one, especially these days where you can search them by computer.
Well, by the way, define one. Give us one.
I wrote one once in an article that I was doing by invitation for Nature, a science magazine in London. I wrote something like, "It was surely reasonable to at least consider adopting it." And the copy editor moved my modifier, "at least," and the meaning changed. I thought, don't they understand that when you invite a grammarian to write about something about language, he might know where to put his adverbs and things? Because if you move it there, you always get a wrong result. I didn't mean it was surely reasonable at least, possibly more than reasonable. I didn't mean they should consider at least adopting it, possibly advertising
right.
it. I meant it was reasonable to at least consider adopting
right.
it. That's the only place to put "at least" that works. It is fully correct. It's a very, very clear case of something that isn't a rule of English and never was.
Well, and this brings us to one of the entries. "Omit stupid grammar teaching" is the title. It's clearly meant to diss exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, I wrote that about Strunk and White, who I must say have written together the most horrible little book. Of all the books there are, I hate it the most.
It's The Elements of Style.
Yes. I'm sorry you had to mention it on the air.
And but it's a Bible to many. So what is your concern with it?
If this is the Bible, don't be religious. This is a silly little book of advice that is either platitudes, like omit needless words. And of course, you can't admit them if they're required. You get crunched up over dense writing if you literally work through your prose trying to omit every word that could have been left out. The book vacillates between platitudes like be clear and outright falsehoods like the word they must never have a singular antecedent.
I have to jump in because you just used an example of something else I wanted to bring up. You said you used the word like to give an example. You very much defend the word like you like it.
Well, at least I would say that when you look at young people saying that the lecture was like really cool and despise them for it, you should have another think about that. The upper class grown-ups that you respect use if you will and similar phrases in exactly the same way. It's a hedge. When you say it is, if you will, an epitaph, what you mean is, I'm not entirely sure that epitaph is the right word here, but it's approximately right. Bear with me. And the young people who say it was like really cool are doing the same thing with like. It's just a hedge. Everybody has them. I don't know why one of them should be despised so much, except that it's risen in frequency among the young in recent years.
In fact, you go through sentences from the Wall Street Journal and give the example with like, and I'll quote some of them. They are, if you will, this country's governing body, or they are like this country's governing body, or I think it's a reason we've done well, part of our mystique, if you will, or I think it's a reason we've done well, part of like our mystique.
That's right. It's the same function. Notice that the if you will is three syllables long, and so it's three times as long as it needs to be, so I suppose there's a few needless words to omit. But the point is that people react very strongly with a kind of allergic reaction to innovations in the speech of the young without thinking through what's actually happened here. We've got one more new use of a word as a hedge. Well, everybody has hedges. This is not a crisis.
Linguist Jeffrey Pullum, we've averted a crisis. He's co-author of the book Far From the Madding Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. Language Log, by the way, is the online website devoted to all sorts of debates on words and how they're used. To link to that, go to our website, here-now.org. But stay here because our conversation continues with Jeffrey Pullum. Do you know what a snow clone is? And what's an egg corn? Anyway, E-G-G-C-O-R-N. Ponder that. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Use of the word like. How like is just a quicker, more efficient, and less formal way of saying if you will, at least according to Pullum. But I asked Pullum to explain the constant use of the word like in conversation. What does he think about that?
In their conversation, there's redundancy in everybody's speech, and different people have different redundancies. I've heard people on the radio, your very own medium, who say, it's not you though, who say every two or three words. I've been astonished that they continue to work as radio reporters, having that higher frequency of hesitation markers. But it's only a style point. That's the thing. If you overuse any feature of the language, it sounds a bit dopey. But we surely shouldn't be concluding anything about intelligence from it. So young people can just use like as much as they want. It's not going to be a measure of whether they're intelligent and whether they will one day be able to write decent essays.
We're talking to Professor Jeffrey Pullum. He's professor of linguistics and distinguished professor of humanities at the University of California. He's also author with Mark Lieberman of Far From the Madding Gerund, Other Dispatches from the Language Log. That's their website where a group of linguists write about everything. It's just a lot of fun. And just there's so much to talk about. But before we let you go, I want to talk about some of the words that you have coined to talk about the trends in speaking. One of them, snow clones. The other, egg corn. Snow clones, what's that?
Well, a snow clone is a kind of ready-made phrase for lazy journalists to plug words into to make a beginning for an article or a turn of phrase in the middle of an article. And it was named after I grumbled about an excessively overused one, where you sort of begin an article something like this. But suppose we're writing an article about Robin Young, and we say, "It is said that the Eskimos have 159 words for snow. Well, Robin Young must have 159 different words for interview because she's done so many of them." That's sort of nonsense. I've read this dozens of times. First, the Eskimos don't have a huge number of different words for snow. That's a myth. And second, this is a really lazy cliché, a cliché of a very specific kind, where almost the whole form of the phrase or sentence is laid out for you, and all you have to do is plug in your own words at certain points.
Guilty
and somebody
as
just
charged.
Suggested calling it a snow clone. Because
oh, guilty as charged, though, because, you know, we talk about it in the office all the time, that it's almost like the structure's there, and you just put the words in, so black is the new gray. You know, that's
yes.
sort of that's
a
shortest,
snow clone for sure.
Right. That's a, well, okay.
X is the new Y, we call it.
Right,
yes. You just plug in your own X and Y, and you've got a phrase of a snappy sort that's
but you know, there's
fashionable.
There's so much media, and you hear it so much that sometimes you have to break it in your ear. Sometimes you have to realize you're writing in that form and break it.
Yes. Keep in mind, by the way, we're not saying there's anything wrong with snow clones. It's just like. This is a constantly changing, shifting thing about the language. New cliches come in. We occasionally mock a cliche, at least point out that it's a new snow clone, not really because there's anything particularly wrong with it, but to highlight a development in the language, because that's what Language Log is about. We write about things that are happening in language that have some current relevance.
Right. Egg corn, a type of slip of the ear?
Yeah, that is more like an actual new concept, because we realized what was happening with the fact that some people, when trying to write down the word acorn, which they thought they knew, would write egg corn. And in fact, it's extremely common.
Wait, they write E-G-G-C-O-R-N?
Yes. Yes, because they thought they were hearing egg corn, and they thought that was a reasonable thing to call a little thing that's about the shape of an egg. And what's interesting about it is it's a slip of the ear, not a slip of the tongue. It's not that they don't know the word. They know it, and they know its meaning. But when they write it down, they reveal they've got a false theory about it, often quite a creative theory about it. And that's really very interesting.
Give us some examples.
A friend of mine, an academic, had always thought she was hearing people say, "to all intensive purposes." But it's not "to all intensive purposes." It's "intents and purposes." So "intents" is the plural of a noun. She knew the phrase. She knew what it meant. But if she had been writing it down, she would have revealed that she had a wrong theory about how the words were put together to make the phrase.
Okay.
That's the kind of thing that happens with egg corns. It hasn't got any particular importance. It's just a neat new mistake, alongside malapropisms, for example, which are quite different. A malapropism is a word that you have learned with the wrong meaning, so you're actually wrong about the word. If you use epitaph and think it means epigram, you really have made a mistake in your lexical learning. It's not a mistake in the lexical learning when you think there's a word eggcorn and you know what it means. You've got the word, you've got the meaning, but you've got a wrong theory that the first part of it is egg.
One last question. Where does one of my favorites fall in? Do you have a name for this? I used to say, when I was much younger, mizzled for misled.
Oh, yes.
Is that an eggcorn?
Spelling pronunciations. No, different. But I have to admit that at one time I stared at this word myself and I was puzzled and wondered just what mizzled might mean, and luckily I learned before I ever said it. But there are plenty of people out there who say mizzled in front of somebody and have to be told at that point, they embarrass themselves. And so you are not alone.
Oh, Professor Jeffrey Pullum, the book is Far From the Matting Gerund and Other Dispatches from Language Log. And by the way, to get to Language Log, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll send you over. It is always such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been fun.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And The Economist,
the greenhouse gas emissions hurt the state's economy, or will they spur a wave of cleaner-burning energy technologies? Under the agreement, California would become the first state to impose a limit on all greenhouse gas emissions, including those from industrial plants. Jim Carlton is environmental writer for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from San Francisco. And Jim, these rules, this plan, they had their final passage in the legislature just yesterday, and they are expected to, you know, maybe face some court battles. But still, first of all, give us a sense of how this story is resonating there in California. How big news is this?
Oh, hi, Robin. This is huge news. I was talking to John Doerr, who's the one of the legendary venture capitalists in Silicon Valley. He helped found Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers. And he was telling me this is probably the biggest, in his opinion, the biggest legislation of the year in the nation, and maybe perhaps worldwide, and perhaps in the past decade.
Huh.
And the reason being is that California is a trend-setting state. When it starts in California, it usually goes to the rest of the country and oftentimes the world. And so what he's saying, and many others, is that this could be really the first kind of salvo in really doing something about global warming.
Well, give us some history. California Assemblywoman Fran Pavley is the former school teacher who's said to really be the force behind this and California's previous environmental initiatives. She said she was motivated by seeing so many kids with asthma in school. But what else happened? I mean, she was a freshman. Yes, strong leadership. But what else happened to make this, you know, go so far and pass?
Well, it's kind of a perfect storm of kind of, bipartisanship actually working. You know, we have a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who everybody knows, and we have a Democrat-dominated legislature. And, you know, as you pointed out, this really kind of started on the Democratic side with the Assemblywoman. But also, Fabian Nunez, who's the Assembly Speaker, had a huge role in this as well. And his role was really in kind of working with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Schwarzenegger really wants to kind of burnish his environmental credentials. He's up for re-election. He's up against a Democratic challenger who isn't doing as well in the polls right now. But Arnold really is trying to reach out to the Democrats in California. And so what's happened, you have a Republican governor who really wants to be reelected, and you have a front burner issue with the Democrats, and it's just kind of is the perfect time for it to pass in California.
Well, you'd also have to have the business community, and Arnold has a very strong arm, as we know, but it still, I would think, would need business leaders to jump by themselves. And we understand one broke away from the pack, as the New York Times put it today. That's Peter Darby of Pacific Gas and Electric, and he broke away early on because he took it upon himself to go study global warming. How much did that kind of decision-making also affect this?
That was huge. And that was something that I pointed out in my articles of the Wall Street Journal, too, is that what really convinced Arnold, I think, to go with this, I mean, as you pointed out, the California Chamber of Commerce in particular had been a big, big ally of his, and they were adamantly opposed to this. They represent a lot of manufacturers and most of the oil and gas industry, and as you mentioned, utilities. Almost all the utilities in California were against this, you know, because of the cost and whatnot. But PG&E, they were the leader on the utility side, but they weren't the only ones. What really kind of did it for Arnold, I think, was when he got a delegation of executives from Silicon Valley. They visited Sacramento last week, and they were telling anybody who had listened, say, look, this is good business. Number one, if we don't get off fossil fuels by 2020, the cost of fossil fuel is going to go astronomical and it's going to hurt us. And number two, California is a leader in clean tech and technologies to do something about alternative energy. And this is actually really good business. So that really resonated with the governor and showed him there was a divided business community in California and that he could do this.
And we understand, too, from you that and others that many business leaders felt it wouldn't happen if businesses were just asked to do it on their own without regulations.
Well, yeah, I think that's been the Bush administration's approach is kind of more the carrot than the stick. And, maybe the jury is out on what works best. But I think that more and more, in government and some of business, they think that, there needs to be some kind of, regulatory approach to this. Now, in California, they are, the governor did make sure to have, a market mechanism so that businesses wouldn't be, just have a hammer over their head all the time. They could, try to, use market, trading and that kind of thing to see this happen.
Is this the cap and sell, the idea? Have I got that right? The idea that you could, it gets complicated, but buy and trade emissions?
Right. I mean, exactly. I think, you could, if you're an emitter and you're kind of going over the limit, well, you can maybe do a carbon sequestration program. You could buy credits, example, planting more forests, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, talk a little more about the divide on this issue, because we understand it's high tech, as you said, very favorable versus smokestack industries. And the complaint is by the people who don't want to do this, that it's going to cost too much. The costs are going to be passed on to the consumers and also going to force industries out of state.
Well, that is the million-dollar question, Robin. I mean, right now we don't really know. I mean, if you talk to the Chamber of Commerce, if you talk to heavy manufacturers, they say this is terrible. This is going to just, ration up our costs, and we're going to have to pass the costs on to the consumer, et cetera, et cetera. But if you talk to the John Doors and the people like that in Silicon Valley, they say, well, that's not true. And, and PG&E is there, too. I mean, PG&E, by the way, they are really heavy into hydroelectric and solar and wind. They're already kind of into renewable energies pretty heavily, and so they don't have quite as much to lose as other companies that are more heavily involved in fossil fuels. So that's one reason they can afford to be kind of proactive on this issue. But
well, how much friction is this causing with the federal government, the Bush administration? Do they see this as a sort of a backdoor attempt to regulate business when, as you said, they want the market to drive it? And also, where might this new proposal end up? Because California is already being sued over its earlier plan to cut emissions from cars and light trucks.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think anything like this, it's a long way to actually being, law, working, because there's going to be litigation for sure. I mean, the auto manufacturers, the oil companies, the gas companies, they're all going to want to try to see this limited, curtailed severely. And as you point out, the Bush administration is pushing more for the voluntary approach, at least for now. So, there's going to be a lot of, red tape before something actually happens.
And we should say 7 Northeast states have approved a cap on CO2 emissions from electric utilities, coal-burning power plants. Now we have California's sweeping plan. It would seem as if the Bush administration, it just seems to be encroaching on the Bush administration's stance.
Oh, this is a thumb in the eye to President Bush, absolutely. And this is the guy, remember, Arnold Schwarzenegger went to Ohio, and he campaigned, this is our man. And he backed him on the war in Iraq, and he's backed him on a lot of big things, immigration. But Schwarzenegger has done kind of a 180 this year. Last year he was kind of attacking Democrats and calling them girly men. there was a lot of publicity about, his girly men comments. But he kind of got his butt kicked at the polls when he tried to, kind of trim the power of the Democrats last year. So he kind of went home and thought about it, and he decided, I want to get things done.
But real quick, I just have to ask you, only have a few seconds left, Jim Carlton. Is he walking the walk? Has he gotten rid of his Hummers?
Well, we'll see about that. I don't know if he's gotten rid of his Hummers, but maybe he's going to start using ethanol.
All right. Jim Carlton, environmental writer for The Wall Street Journal, speaking to us from San Francisco about California's new plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions passed in the legislature, probably headed to the courts. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now. Time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. We spoke this week with historian Doug Brinkley, author of The Great Deluge, his account of Hurricane Katrina. Brinkley said that what he refers to as the Bush administration inaction in New Orleans is actually an action, in that the lack of rebuilding has kept largely Democratic black neighborhoods empty, and that in turn is converting Louisiana from the only blue state in the South to a red Republican state. Many of you appreciated Doug's analysis. Dennis Sanders of Minneapolis, Minnesota, didn't buy it. He writes, Douglas Brinkley's assertion is absurd. Yes, the Bush administration did a horrible job in the aftermath of Katrina, but engaging in conspiracy theories doesn't help. Let's hold people accountable. Let's not engage in witch hunts. We also received a lot of response to our interview last week with Randall Balmer, author of Thy Kingdom Come, An Evangelical's Lament, a lament that, as the religious right has become more politically powerful, it's also strayed from the gospel. John Hartman of Danbury, North Carolina, had this thought.
I want to compliment him on his courage and honesty. It can't be very popular for an evangelical Christian to say and publish things that question the wisdom of the religious right. Amen, brother.
But during our conversation, Balmer took issue with two religious right organizations which are pro-life, but also defend the Bush administration's policy on the use of torture on terrorism suspects. Balmer's criticism of what he saw as hypocrisy prompted this call.
Hi, my name's Bill Worth. I'm calling from Greenville, North Carolina. There's a difference between a fetus and a full-grown person that takes militant action towards our government and our citizens. You're talking about abortion, which is killing. Torture is torture. Yeah, it's mean, it's nasty, it's not nice, but it's not beheading people like our allies overseas do.
Well, moving on to our Katrina coverage, this week we spoke with Howard Rogers III, director of the New Orleans Council on Aging. Many of you appreciated our update on the elderly in New Orleans a year after Katrina. Dennis Reffeld of Helena, Montana, had a dry-eyed response, especially to Howard's claim that FEMA is investigating problems with formaldehyde in trailers. Dennis writes, what a load of malarkey. I have a trailer very similar to the ones manufactured for FEMA, as do literally millions of other happy, healthy, elderly individuals. This guy is obviously another bleeding-heart liberal queuing up to take another cheap shot at the federal government. Well, thank you, Dennis, for the reminder that we forgot to note that in August, FEMA confirmed that there was a problem with some brands of trailers used to house Katrina evacuees, and the agency is studying ways to reduce formaldehyde levels in those trailers. Well, finally, I shared some thoughts this week about rafting down the Green River in Utah and hearing, in a visit to church, the words I needed to get me back home to work. They were in a combination of two great spirituals, No Hiding Place and Two Wings.
These two wings should fail me. I want you to make me with another bed. Oh, give me two wings.
Well, David Breakstone of Watertown, Massachusetts writes, we were also in Bryce and Zion National Parks a decade ago. Sheer magic. The canyon walls echo and re-echo with voices of spirits as old as those impossibly red rocks. Why ever go back home? This is home. Randall Harris of Oregon adds, my wife Tanya and I are originally from Salt Lake City, and we usually hide our faces and whisper our point of origin when asked by strangers. Well, Tuesday, you made us feel like shouting to everyone, we're from Utah! We're from Utah! Nate Clow of Cedar Rapids, Iowa wrote, I listen while driving my truck south through cornfields after a day of delivering food here in Iowa, and I loved that church song you ended with. Thanks for the inspiration. Well, how about a little more? Here are the sounds of the Sunday service at the Holiday United Church of Christ in Salt Lake City, Utah, the visiting Golden Voices Gospel Ensemble Choir.
I stop by to tell you, trouble's gonna come. You're gonna run to the rocks to hide your face. You know the rocks are gonna cry out. No, this is no hiding place.
Everybody, summer's almost over. Get ready to get back to work. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address, letters@here-now.org, letters@here-now.org, or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Are creating a document of the city's long struggle back. Some of the people behind the cameras are amateurs, inspired by the devastation to record what they see. Others are professional filmmakers who've been living and working in the city for years. The nonprofit New Orleans Video Access Center, or NOVAC, has been working with local filmmakers for more than 30 years, but since Katrina, the group has expanded its reach. NOVAC has premiered a dozen short videos on the internet, documenting the devastation of Katrina and the reconstruction of the city. And as a result, they're reaching hundreds of thousands of viewers. Here's a clip from one NOVAC film called The Drive.
I was in Vietnam in 1967, and it wasn't this bad over there as far as the demolition and destruction that this hurricane brought in the lower Nightwall. It couldn't even compare to that. So it's just beyond words to describe, you know, what you're looking at when you come down in this area. I want to come home, but nothing to come back to.
Tim Ryan is NOVAC's executive director. He also directed some of the films, and he joins us on the line from New Orleans. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
In the aftermath of Katrina, knowing what you do, your group, as we said, predates Katrina, what did you think? Did you change your mission? Did you adjust? What happened?
Well, our mission really hasn't changed. The New Orleans Video Access Center has been around for about 34 years now. And it's been a community media center documenting stories from a community point of view in New Orleans. So we haven't necessarily changed our mission. We have, however, received additional funding and a sense of urgency to document this amazing part of our history. And that led us to produce the Driving series as well as the entire Katrina documentary short project.
Let's talk about the Driving series. There's a film called The Drive. You were co-producer. And it essentially, it's one huge, long drive through the Ninth Ward, broken up with sort of witness testimonials. Tell us about that film.
The drive was designed to provide a point of view to folks that couldn't come down here and see it firsthand. And in fact, we've completed the first segment of four on the lower Ninth Ward. We're also going to be driving through three other devastated neighborhoods, including Mid-City, Lakeview, and New Orleans East. So the idea was to provide very simply, in a raw way, the point of view of someone driving through these neighborhoods, and the fact that the drive goes on and on and on and on, and the devastation feels like it's never going to end.
It's just amazing. We heard earlier from a Vietnam veteran featured in the film, and he was saying, you know, it just doesn't even compare to the devastation of war. And that seems to be one of the reasons. It just, you watch this footage go by out a car window, and it just keeps coming. It doesn't stop.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of people throughout the nation still don't quite understand. The magnitude of this devastation is just unbelievable. And a lot of folks will ask me, friends and family members from out of state, you know, are things back to normal? Is everything fine now? And I just don't think they get it, that this was truly a spectacular event that there just is no precedent. There's no comparison.
Another film features Lewis Harding. He's a grass cutter in New Orleans who saved up enough money to buy 10 properties. First, I want to hear from him. Let's listen.
The center was not destroyed by the storm. The center was more or less destroyed by the flooding of the levees. That water moved and moved all this stuff in here and jammed all this stuff up. But this is where we was at, partner. We were trying to get it done.
Tell us a little bit more about Lewis Harding, the grass cutter.
This was directed by a filmmaker named Brent Joseph. And Lewis Harding is one of those self-made kind of guys that worked his tail off and was smart enough or resourceful enough to save his money. He started buying real estate. And he's now 72 years old, and he owns 10, 12 properties. But what's also really interesting about Mr. Harding is that he's a real activist in his community, and he's created a community center for young African-American kids that teaches them or helps teach them about their history and helps build self-esteem and tries to show these kids that there's so many things they can do other than playing football or selling drugs. And it's called the Marcus Garvey Community Center.
After the athlete. It's just, you're so struck in watching this film. It's called A Loud Color. You're so struck with, you know, here's the guy who cut grass and put every penny into real estate. And real estate was the worst investment you could have in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's also powerful to see him out there. This guy's 72. To see him out there basically by himself cleaning up. And he said, we've got to rebuild. We've got to make the city better. And it just kind of shows the resourcefulness. And it challenges some of the stereotypes, I think, of what people think folks from New Orleans are like, that they're looking for handouts, that they're all on welfare. This is, Mr. Harding's one of thousands and thousands of examples of people here that they're hardworking, taxpaying citizens that aren't criminals and that are, you know, productive members of our society.
Tim Ryan is with the New Orleans Video Access Center, or NOVAC. Tim, how many Katrina films have you posted so far?
I believe we have 10 short documentaries posted, maybe 11. There's really two directions we wanted to go with this overall project. The motivation was to show the duality of life in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. So on the one hand, we have the drive. But then what we wanted to do was to show kind of the other side of New Orleans right now. We've got so many amazing people and neighborhoods and the culture and the spirit. We wanted to show people that this is truly an American city that's worth rebuilding. It may not be back to normal for a long time, but there is life. There are people working and enjoying their lives in New Orleans right now. And that's what makes it so confusing. For me, personally, even, it's like, I know about this devastation, and I see it every day working on this project, but I also see the other side of New Orleans, that there's so many great things that are happening.
NOVAC's been around for 30 years, but how different is the experience now that you do have all of these channels to put this video on, YouTube, and people can Google things? That's probably really changed the work that you do.
Yeah, it has. In the past, NOVAC has been able to present their work at different arts organizations and community meetings. But then, I think what's amazing right now is this whole democratization of storytelling through the Internet. And what just still blows me away to this day is that I could, in theory, sit down with a video camera, interview my wife and my two dogs in our FEMA trailer. I can import that into my laptop, do some quick edits. I could add some music, some transitions, some titles, compress it, and then upload it to the Internet. And then immediately, it's available for millions and millions of people to watch.
Tim Ryan is executive producer of New Orleans Video Access Center, or NOVAC. To see some of the videos we've been talking about, go to our website, here-now.org.
I get drunk to forget my troubles. So laced streetcars look like toys.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. We want to thank NPR affiliate KUER in Salt Lake City for their help this week. We also want to thank and say a warm goodbye to Here and Now intern Jamie Ulrich, who leaves us today. And we would have said best of luck and many thanks, Jamie, even if you didn't bring in all those baked goods and whatnot this morning. Very appreciated. I'm Robin Young. Join us again Here and Now.
Tell me not to be impatient. They say every dog has his day.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Yet I'm beginning to live and look like one every day.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now. We'll look at the movement to buy local. Also, Steve McCurry, who years ago took that iconic photo of a green-eyed Afghan woman, now he's turning his lens on workers around the world. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.